Now that we have two-thirds of the councillors here, we can start on the motions. Go ahead, Sherry.
First of all, we'd just like to announce that we are starting the recording. Barbara Knight is participating remotely. And if everyone would please remember to speak into the microphone and announce their name before speaking, that would be extremely helpful. And we'll start the afternoon session. Thank you.
Yeah, we're starting with the council motions.
Okay, so it's Jonathan Robinson. The first motion is on the working group on consumer trust, consumer choice and competition. This is a working group I worked on and, in fact, had, I think, two different chairs during the course of its existence and a very active group in preparing a whole series of different measures by which the success of the new GTLD program might be measured in future. These are not the criteria by which it will be measured, but this is the response proposed by this group to a request from the board in order that they can fulfill their requirements in terms of the affirmation of commitments, in fact. And the request that's come from there. So I think that's right, isn't it? It's from the affirmation of commitment. So that's where this comes from. This has been through the draft letter on this has been through various iterations and finally been posted for public comment. The public comments have been reviewed and fed back. However, there's essentially a last-minute hiccup, if you like, in that where all of this work was done and where it came from was predated the, at least the majority of the work predated the knowledge of the landscape of the new GTLD applications. So in many ways, the mindset was thinking very much, was focused very much on how new generic and open TLDs might impact the landscape. Whereas, in fact, what we now know is that there is a significant participation in the applicant landscape of brands and others. So what I think is likely to happen is what we're suggesting happens is that the motion is accepted but deferred. So we're proposing to motivate for a deferral such that the working group has an opportunity to reconvene and reappraise the work it's done on the basis of the new GTLD landscape. So that's where we're at on that motion.
Yeah, and just, this is Jeff Newman, just to add, there are criteria in the letter, as Jonathan said, which are really geared towards open top-level domains. And, you know, we have to think a couple years ahead. And if we want new TLDs to be introduced on a continuous basis, we actually need to be concerned with how the evaluation of these new TLDs is going to take place. And we don't want to artificially set up the new TLD program to receive bad evaluations. And so there are criteria for things like consumer choice that involve things like, does the applicant, or actually the TLD, do they adequately disclose on their website the benefits of having the TLD and the restrictions involved in the top-level domain? And you look at that and you say, well, okay, that kind of makes sense for any of the open TLDs. So if you're running, a .web, let's say, and, you know, maybe on your website when you talk about come register a domain name, and here's why you would want to register in .web and all the good things it can do, and by the way, here are restrictions if there are any. That certainly makes sense. But if you're .newstar, and we're going to use that as our primary brand site, we're not going to put on our homepage, hey, you know, come look at .newstar. We've registered it for these reasons. You know, we're going to have just our normal homepage. So we wouldn't want any of the brands to get dinged, if you will, for not disclosing on our homepage the benefits of having a .newstar because it's not even open. So those are the types of things that it, you know, and this came at my request to just relook at some of the criteria that have been developed and see whether they apply in a number of situations. And if not, let's account for that so that it doesn't skew the results to make it look like the TLD program as a whole has been a failure.
So this is Keith and Jeff. I think from my understanding, there seems to be some agreement or concurrence with some of the folks who were involved in developing the metrics that, yeah, maybe they ought to take another look at things. At least that's my understanding. Maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, I think that's right, although they are very concerned that this is just a delay tactic. So if we do defer it, and good thing we have Jonathan on the group, I'm sure Jonathan will be working with them to get a result as quickly as possible and to demonstrate at least our commitment to making it go quickly, because we do realize the results of this are going to be sent to the board, and then the board's going to select a review team that has to be in place and working by the time 1 year after the delegation of TLDs. And while that sounds like a long way away, it actually isn't. And so we just need to show them good faith in working. And I'm hoping the other groups that support the deferral are also in the same mindset. Okay, so the second one, Jonathan, you just had it pulled up. If you can, I'm still working on getting it up. But I think the second one is on, uniformity of contracts. So in 2009, there was a registration abuse working group. And so again, this is 2009. There were a number of recommendations that came out of it. And we as a council have dealt with all of them except for this last one. And this last recommendation that came out of the group, it wasn't a consensus recommendation. It was what was labeled as strong support. We, as registries and also the registrars and the non-commercial stakeholder group, opposed this recommendation, which was basically to look at all of the contracts that registries have with registrars and registrars have with registrants to see if we could create uniform contractual language amongst all the registries and the registrars. Now, obviously, the registries opposed and the registrars opposed because we're all different. We shouldn't, we all have different business models. And frankly, we shouldn't be concentrating on contractual language. If there's a problem, then the problem, the abuse, should be addressed, not the contractual language. And in this organization, in ICANN in general, there's been, in the past several years, a heavily focus on contractual language instead of actually resolving the issue. So when I went and looked back at the report, it's interesting because the only people that supported this recommendation, they were all members of the business constituency. There were 8 members of the business constituency on the working group, and the other 6 members that were on the working group were from the non-commercial and the registries and the registrars. So the only group that supported it were the business constituency, but because there were 8 members of the business constituency, it looked like the vote was 8 in favor and 6 against. Which I think, looking back, was probably a travesty that the chair of that group actually labeled it that there was strong support. It should have been labeled there was some support and strong opposition, but it was not labeled that way. So these are points I'm going to make tomorrow. I'm assuming we have not changed in the 3 years of talking about this issue, that we are still against it. It is a really low threshold to start a PDP. I know the registrars will oppose it, but in the end, if the commercial stakeholder group votes in favor of it and the non-commercial group votes in favor of it, kind of stuck with another PDP, which is a waste of resources in my view. And this is probably part of a larger problem we need to address.
I just wanted a quick question there, Jeff. If this highlights any area where there's a process improvement required in the way in which working groups or work, if there's a way in which we could limit, for example, the number of votes that any single group could put into something like that.
So that's an excellent point. And actually, so this was 2009 that report came out. Since then, we've come out with the working group guidelines. And I don't believe so those working group guidelines actually do address the situation and gives more guidance on that. And we have not, at least as far as I've seen in outputs from working groups, I don't think we've had that problem. So while in 2009 it was a problem, I think we've sort of fixed it. But it's something that, you know, you as hopefully the next chair will certainly need to keep an eye on, and us as counselors, to make sure that working groups don't abuse their position and make sure that they take into account groups as opposed to individuals.
David, one final point. It's Jonathan again. So, yeah, so that if the working group guidelines help us, that's a good step forward in terms of how we deal with it at the working group level. Of course, it doesn't address the low threshold to kick the process off in any event, an issues report or even a PDP. So that's something we'll need to keep an eye on and give some more thought to.
Does that complete the motions?
Oh, no. I think there are 7 or 8 of them. So the next one, again, I'm looking on Jonathan's computer because he's got them pulled up. Okay, issue report on the uniformity of reporting. This one, actually, I think is an okay one to support. This also actually came out of the same registration abuse working group in 2009. So I lied. It's actually, this is the last one, not the one before. This one actually just asks ICANN to come out with a common set of reporting with issues, with abuse issues that are reported to it, so sort of dashboards and other kinds of, to basically look into other tools that ICANN can actually give to the community so that abuse can actually be measured. I think this one is something that makes a lot of sense and hopefully will not involve too much in the way of resources. So at least from my personal perspective, I think it makes sense. And Chuck's up to the mic, so let's see what Chuck thinks.
Well, in my initial comments that I sent to the list, Chuck Gomes, okay, I assume everybody heard that, but was, you know, it's just a request for an issue report, and that's pretty easy, and it's probably okay to support. But I guess a question just popped into my mind as I was looking at it again. Do we really need a PDP on this particular issue? It doesn't seem like this is a substantial policy effort. I'm okay with it. I mean, what the goal is, what the intent is, seems fine. But I'm not sure a PDP is needed for this. And maybe I'm wrong on that, but that's my question.
And I think it's a very good point. You could still have an issue report and then just decide to initiate the policy process without it being a PDP. I think in the end, you still need some sort of paper that comes out that describes the potential issues. But I think you're absolutely right. It doesn't need a formal PDP as we think about it, which relates to our contracts.
Yeah, and thanks, Jeff. Chuck again. One of the counselors might want to think about making that point that we think an issue report would be helpful, but we're not sure that ultimately it would result in a PDP because we think it could be accomplished without that. Just so you give I see the. Go ahead, Jonathan.
Thanks, Chuck. I've got an interesting question here because just when I thought I understood everything, I clearly don't. I thought the understanding that I was starting to develop was that a PDP is the process by which we have to determine policy, which may or may not be consensus policy. So when we're talking about that this may give rise to a policy process, my understanding is that is a PDP regardless. It's just that the PDP may or may not give rise to consensus policy, but I'm sure you're going to help me here.
Well, but still, whether a PDP results in consensus policy or not, it's a very comprehensive process, involves a lot of resources and so forth. So what I'm suggesting, or the question I'm asking is, do you really need a PDP, whether it's heading towards consensus policy or not for this? And I'm thinking not.
So there, and Chuck's exactly right, there are two primary reasons you do a PDP. One is that the eventual outcome could be a consensus policy and therefore binding on the contracted parties. The other reason you do it is because even if it's not something that the contracted parties would do, there's a higher threshold when it goes up to the board for the board to actually reject it, if you will. If they reject something that's got that goes through a PDP and it's got a certain amount of support of the council, there's got to be a good reason, and the board has to send it back. I mean, there's much higher threshold. if something just goes through the council as just an ordinary policy process or recommendation, there's nothing that the board can do whatever it wants. And so, the two reasons you do the PDP again are because of the higher threshold that the board would have to reject it and or the fact that it would be binding on the registries and registrars.
Now, one more question, Chuck, again, has to be asked in this regard. You heard me ask it over the weekend and with the council. Does staff have the resources to do this issues report right now? Because just with the motions we're looking at right now, there are some that are, in my opinion, a lot higher priority. So I think that question needs to be asked as well.
So it's Jonathan. I think there's a couple of thoughts there. I mean, the first is clearly that one of them is going to be whether I end up in the chair or not. There's got to be substantial effort on resource planning and prioritization. And actually, you've mentioned a couple of times in this session today, Chuck, this concept of substantial or not. And so for me, that's put a little light bulb on, because it's clearly one of the tests by which one might prioritize the work. You know, I'm starting to envisage a table of priority where substantial is one test, and perhaps even the substantiality of it or not. You know, how many marks out of one, two, or three does it get for substantial? That might be one area. And I suppose one of the things we might want from our stakeholder group to feed into the council is our view of prioritization, so that when the council deliberates on the prioritization of resources, we've got a clear steer from this stakeholder group as to those rankings. So that might be helpful in that process. Okay, just one other follow-on comment then. So if we are to undertake at council level, and this is probably slightly outside of the scope of our stakeholder group, but it's certainly helpful to me, if we are to undertake work that on policy that does not follow the PDP process, by which process should we undertake that policy work? That's the question that's in my mind.
Chuck, I think, I'd like to hear from.
Okay, well, it doesn't matter to me which one. Chuck, again. We've done a lot of things in that regard. Drafting teams. We ask staff to do some stuff, and then the council reviews it. I think there are other ways. A key question in this particular, with regard to this particular issue, is could it be accomplished without a PDP and still get community buy-in and so forth? It seems to me like it could be, but we're talking about reporting. it doesn't sound too controversial to me. It might be. You never know in this world. But so there are other mechanisms to do that, I think.
Okay, so on motion number 4, this is a motion for the initiation of a policy development process on our favorite subject, the protection of certain international organization names and all GTLDs. A couple points to stress there. It's for all GTLDs and not just for new GTLDs. But this is basically, there was a preliminary issue report followed by a comment period followed by the final issue report on the protection of international organizations, whether those are international governmental organizations and international non-governmental organizations, including the Olympic marks and the Red Cross marks. Coupled in with this is sort of the other things. Sorry, let me take a step back. So there's a drafting team right now that's working on only the issues of presented from the GAC proposal in September 2011 on the protection of Olympic and Red Cross marks at the top and second level. The top level, we made recommendations, went through the GNSO, went to the board. Board didn't adopt them for this current round. But then we went back as a drafting team of the council and started working on the second level recommendations. The drafting team came out with a report, which is now out for public comment, which states that we, the drafting team, recommend a temporary reservation on the Olympic and Red Cross marks that are indicated in the GAC advice letter until such time that there's a PDP and the results of that PDP are known, and then we'd be guided by the results of the PDP. So in other words, we'll just temporarily block those from registration so that in the end, if the PDP decides to protect those marks, then you know, they'll never be released. They'll put on a permanent reservation with maybe some exception processes. Or if the PDP comes out and says, no, they're not even worth protecting, that's probably a bad way to put it, but that decides that these protections shouldn't apply, then they can easily be released. It's much easier to do it that way than to actually release the names and then have a PDP say they should have been reserved in the first place and have some process to pull them back. Given that, this is working in parallel, this other issue report. So you have a drafting team recommendations that are out for public comment until today or yesterday, and a reply period that ends November 7th or November 9th. But you also have this motion. So in theory, this motion could be, I expect it to be deferred until after you get public comments on the other, but it doesn't necessarily have to be. Because part of that drafting team recommendations were that we wanted a PDP. We recommended a PDP be done on this. So, and Chuck is a member of the drafting team. And let me turn it over to Chuck to speak and talk a little bit more about that.
Thanks, Jeff. Chuck again. Sorry for being up here so much. My own personal opinion, I'd like to see it not deferred just because we need to move this thing forward. Now, we might have to put some sort of a condition on it based on input, you know, I don't know how you do that, from the comment period. But anything we can do to expedite this. Now, in reality, if we get the charter developed and the working group formed before the, and I don't know if you can really form the working group till you pass the motion, but I'd rather see it not deferred, and I think, could be wrong, that there's pretty good unanimous support in the community and on the council for moving ahead with a PDP. Even in the working group, that was one thing there was strong agreement on, we need a PDP. Now, secondly, I thought that Thomas Rickert proposed an interesting modification to this motion over the weekend. And that was in response to the NCSG concern. In particular, Aubrey and Wendy were concerned about if you approve a moratorium, there's kind of this implication that it might influence the PDP working group and so forth. And his compromise, if I got it correctly, was to not initiate the moratorium until you see that the PDP is not going to finish in time. Simple, fairly simple little modification. Some of us may, you know, agree with Aubrey or Wendy and their concern or not. Regardless, it's a fairly easy accommodation to their concern, and I personally would be okay with that accommodation.
Yeah, now that you brought that up, I do recall that. It's interesting because the board themselves, you know, if you relate it to what the board has said that they favor or that unless the GNSO advises otherwise, that they were leaning towards the moratorium anyway. So whether we say it or it's said by the board, there's going to be a moratorium. But I don't necessarily have an issue one way or the other.
Thanks, Jeff. Chuck again. But that's fine. The board can do that. You know, I think internally within on the council and the GNSO as a whole, accommodating that concern, we haven't lost anything. You know, we're showing support for a moratorium if the PDP doesn't finish in time. We're not very far apart, really.
So I'll take my I'll put my drafting team chair hat on because I was the chair of this drafting team. Do you think that's something that the council should be approving, or that's something, because I'm not sure the drafting team would necessarily agree with that. I'm not saying the council can't change it, and it's an interesting suggestion from Thomas, but that is almost the type of thing that I'd want to make sure that the rest of the drafting team was comfortable with. And maybe I'll just throw it out to the council because there's obviously a bunch of overlap and throw it out and to just say, look, you know, the IP interests are going to be on the, you know, they're on the council, and just say, look, is that something you guys can live with? It's a slight change. If you guys can live with it, then I'm willing to approve that as a friendly amendment. If not, and you think it's a change or need to go back, then I'm going to just stick with the way it is.
Chuck again, and I think that's okay. It's an open council meeting, so asking for input right there. But I can't imagine why anybody in our drafting team, I think you're right, it would be nice to put it by them, but and I suggest you do that tomorrow, but why would anybody on the drafting team have a problem with that? The end result is the same. If the PDP doesn't finish in time, we're going to have a moratorium. It's just that we don't have this precedent set. Again, whether you agree with Aubrey or Wendy in terms of the seriousness of that, we can put aside. Let's just respect it. And what's the end result's the same, is it not?
Sort of. I mean, what does finish in time mean? When is in time? Is it a month before the first new TLD launches? Is it at the time that the first TLD signs an agreement with ICANN? That's a question I think that needs to be answered. What does it mean to be finished in time, and what does it mean to be finished?
Well, and I think we can deal with that. Chuck, again, for the recording. We can deal with that because we know that once the PDP finishes its work and comes up with a recommendation, that then goes to the council. The council has to put out a comment period and get response, and then it needs to go to the board. And so you can predict, you know, we'll know by, you know, probably if the PDP isn't finished by March or so, we're going to have a pretty good idea. This thing can't wrap up that quickly.
Even working back from, this is Jeff Newman again, even working backwards, there's 84 days built into a PDP of public comment periods at a minimum. 84 days. So that's almost 3 months. If all the work were done today and finished tomorrow, that would mean December, January would be the earliest that it could be done. And we haven't even... So I hear what you're saying, and I understand from an optics. Let's just see. Let's throw it out there and see what people think. Yeah. Okay, so motion 5. How are we working on time? Because I know we have people coming in. So the next one should be pretty fast, I think.
Yeah.
I hope.
Yeah.
So the next motion is a motion on Thick Who Is to approve the PDP to move forward with, to approve the charter. The PDP has already been approved. Now it's to approve the charter for the Thick Who Is PDP. There's been some great participation from Keith and from Ray Facet. I've been on that group. Carolyn has been on that as well. So it's gotten some good registry representation. We had a charter that we all agreed on, and that was finalized a week and a half or so ago. And Aubrey has come back with some last-minute changes that have been, in my view, fairly controversial. And I think the charter as it is fine, and I think we should move forward with it. My gut is, so just so you know what Aubrey is trying to do, right now the charter says that you look at, I'm paraphrasing, but you basically look at what are the privacy and data protection implications of the Thick Who Is, essentially. Aubrey would like to expand that to make it, what is the effect on all rights, including freedom of speech, freedom of association, and all sorts of, actually it's not even that specific. It's all international rights, essentially. And I think that is extremely broad. And my biggest concern about this one is that this is an issue that the non-commercial stakeholder group and others have with Who Is in general. And I don't want this PDP to turn into a PDP on Who Is in general. It's not that I don't care about privacy and data protection and freedom of association, you know, I do care about that stuff. Just ask my wife, she'll tell you. But that said, I think this PDP should be very specific to the benefits and the pros and the cons of the Thick Who Is as Thick Who Is, not as Who Is, and should only be comparing it to the thin who is model and not to who is at all. So this is not to look at the privacy implications of who is data at all. It's really to look at the implication of collecting more and displaying more data. And there is a distinction, even though it may sound subtle. I think there are members of the community that want to turn this into a full PDP on who is. I think we should send a clear message that that is not what we approved and that we should support the current charter because it really looks at the differences. It may not be the most popular move with the non-commercial stakeholder group, but I believe it is in line with what we approved as a PDP, and this PDP should not be used to push an agenda on broader who is. So can I get some feedback on that?
I agree.
Give me an amen.
Amen. Okay. Thank you. So that's the quiz. And then, okay, the last, is it the last one or are there two more? Oh, two more. One of them is to approve, to adopt the inter-registrar transfer policy, Part C, final report and recommendations. These are recommendations. This is the third part of initially five PDPs on inter-registrar transfer policy. This really involves the definition of change of control or what to do with change of control of a registrant. There's recommendations on changing some terminology, distinguishing between a transfer between registrars and a transfer between registrants. I think there are some really good recommendations. Barbara has been on this since the beginning. I don't know if Barbara, and she's on the line, I don't know if she wants to add to it. I think there's also a resolution in here to basically combine everything that's left into IRTPC Part D as opposed to Part D and E. So, Barbara, is there anything you want to say about this?
Thank you, Jeff. This is Barbara. And just to be very brief, the biggest impact really to the registries has to do with just the addition of using the IN ID in addition to any proprietary ID. So from our perspective, you know, I feel like you did a pretty good job just summing it up. As he said, they want to basically take the remaining two PDPs and combine them into one, which I think we should be able to do fairly easily. And so I don't anticipate we should have any real issues in supporting this. And I know that Paul also worked on this one, as well as Roy. So I think we all feel quite comfortable in being able to support the recommendations that were made in this final report.
Great. Thank you, Barbara. And a big thank you for actually being a part of all of these PDPs. And hopefully only one more to go, Barbara. Can we count on you for Part D?
We're looking forward to it, I think. It's amazing how quickly James and Avery did a really good job of keeping this one moving along. And so, you know, I'm very pleased to say that we were able to get it all wrapped up with the final report issued in about a year. So in PDP time, that's pretty impressive. So thanks to everybody who was working on that.
Yes, and actually, as Barbara was kind of implying, this PDP moved faster than most, if not all, of the previous ones before it, not just for transfers, but in general. And it actually shows that if you have a group that's willing to move fast and to actually adhere to timelines, PDPs don't have to be several years long at all. This one was about 9 months from beginning to end, which is really good. And so I think it's a success story of the PDP process. All right, number seven, last one. There's Ching. Okay. The last one is a GNSO Council motion to initiate an issue report on Recommendation 2 of the International Registration Data Working Group, the IRDWG, and I'll turn it over to Ching.
Right, you read this. I mean, you sound better than I do, so I just took the... So this one is actually put it in the simple form is that there's four recommendations from the IRD Working Group final report. The report has been delivered to the board, so while the community, GNSO, is waiting for the response from the board, it's the community thing, and we think, as the registry think, that we should move forward and work on the recommendation two, which has to do with the creating this issue report on translation and transliteration of the contact information for the IRD. So the rest three are more technical, but this one is more policy related to registrar, basically, and also registrar. So I think this is a less controversial one. So that's it. That's it, David.
Thanks. You now have the information you need for voting on the council.
Well, I think this might be obvious, but we do need to address one more topic, and there is going to be an election of the chair. And I think I know what the answer is, but the councilors need some guidance on how to vote. Currently, the election, or not currently, the election's between Jonathan, over here on my right, and Thomas Rickert, who is an NCA, a member of the, so he's an NCA, nominating committee appointee, and he's on the contracted party's House side. So I just need to know from the stakeholder group and whether we support Jonathan. I know this is obvious, right? But whether we support Jonathan, so I think we need to hear from members of the group as to whether we support Jonathan or Thomas.
This is Keith. I don't think we need a formal motion or anything, but we, of course, support Jonathan. So.
I'd support Jonathan.
Is there anyone here?
Is there anyone here who does not support Jonathan?
Fight, fight, fight.
This is Chuck again. Of course, I support him. But remember, it's quite likely that there will not be an election on the first vote, which will mean there will be a second election, could be immediately following, that would take the leading candidate and and none of the above, and there'd be an election on that. So we also need to make a decision on that.
Right. So what Chuck's saying is the way the procedures work is that in order to get elected chair of the council, you need 60% of both houses, or I should say of each house, in order to get elected. So there's a couple scenarios that could work out. So if the other side or the other house, non-contracted party's house, all votes in favor of Thomas, and we all vote in favor of Jonathan, with the exception of Thomas, right? Thomas would probably vote for himself, and he's in our house. There's a possibility that Thomas could be the leading candidate, and it would be between Thomas and none of the above. So we need to decide whether we would vote for Thomas or none of the above. And if we voted for none of the above, the effect of that would be essentially that the two vice chairs would then take over the council until such time that a chair could be approved. So we, the executive committee of the registry stakeholder group, has talked about this issue. And unless Ken says I'm wrong, obviously the last thing we want to do is throw our election and our GNSO council in sort of a constitutional crisis. So if for whatever reason it came down to between Thomas and none of the above, that we would support Thomas. So that was the recommendation of the executive committee. But let's.
I only have one question. If there was an unlikely scenario where in the first round, and it could happen with the recusals or something, the vote was equally split, a tie, what are the provisions for managing a tie? A revote, whatever it may be, I honestly can't remember.
Then I take over.
Chuck, it's Jonathan. Can we just finish with the other stuff before we go into the tie? Because we've got Thomas versus Thomas as leading candidate versus none of the above, and Jonathan as leading candidate versus none of the above. Now, I think perhaps the assumption is that if it's Jonathan versus none of the above, we would vote for Jonathan, but I just need to be reassured that that's the case.
I love the talking in the third person there. So you're going to say when you vote, Jonathan votes for Jonathan. I think that's right. I think, you know, if it's Jonathan versus none of the above, I think the assumption is that we support you or Jonathan. Any disagreement there?
No, that's right.
Okay.
No disagreement.
I hope everyone recognizes we can have some fun. In the case of a tie, Ken, it's going to be pushed out. There has to be another nomination period.
Okay, that's
and,
all I
And it's going to be a minimum of 30 days more, okay. Just like it is if we don't have an election after the none of the above and whoever the leading candidate is.
Now, if we have any further instructions in the first or second ballot, that's fine. I do have one more question about timing. I am not certain whether or not somebody may try to appoint the vice chairs of the constituency prior of the constituencies prior to the election. I'm not sure how that process goes, but I would assume that we do not appoint vice chairs until after the election is over. Am I correct?
So, thanks, Ken. This is Keith. It's my understanding that we've actually already communicated to the council, to council chair, that the contracted party's house has nominated or has identified Mason as our vice chair. Now, whether, you know, he wouldn't take his seat until the appropriate time. But that decision's already been made and has been communicated to the council.
Now, Chuck, again, a process question there. I don't recall if that was ever confirmed by the membership, was it? I'm for it, but I'm not sure it was. So I don't think our executive committee is authorized to elect the vice chair.
We were under a time constraint. There was less than 24 hours, and I went ahead and notified that the executive committee supported Mason. But it would be a good idea to have it ratified. Can you make that an action item? Because we don't have a quorum, do we?
We don't have a quorum?
Do we?
Sure.
All right. If we have a quorum, that's fine.
Oh, we have, I see Ray from Jobs, I see Carrie. Carolyn, I see,
Carrie.
Carrie
might be on the phone.
Yeah.
Naughty votes with the Georgia.
Carrie, you see him?
I think we do have a quorum here.
Sherry is there.
Yeah, we only need 8 for a quorum.
You want me to call?
So, why don't we do that?
All right, I'm going to call a voice vote for support of Mason Cole as being vice chair for the contracted party house. All right, Neustar.
Yes.
Verisign.
Yes.
Aphilius.
In support.
PIR.
Yes.
Musée Delma, are you on, Kerry? He's not, but he's indicated he will vote with the majority. Dot Co-op?
Yes.
CETA is not participating today. Employ Media?
Yes.
Puntcat? Not present. Dot Travel? It's Byron. Byron is not in the room, but he has indicated he will vote with the majority. Telnick? Is not able to participate today. Dot Asia?
Yes.
ICM?
Yes.
And Universal Postal Union was unable to participate today. So we have 8 voting in support, and with Carrie's vote as well as Dot Travel's vote, Musée Delma and Dot Travel, we have a supermajority.
Thank you. That by a supermajority, then Mason nomination as vice chair is confirmed. Selection as vice chair is confirmed.
That's correct. Thank you.
We're still in GNSO updates, GNSO review and structure. We are going to have a presentation on the... who is protocol, but is, oh, they're, okay. Are you ready to go, please?
Okay. Thank you, David, and thank you, RISG, for giving us this opportunity to update you on the recent IETF work on the WHOIS protocol. So there's within the latest couple of years, there's a growing consensus within the ICANN community about the need to update the WHOIS protocol, as it does not support internationalization and other key deficiencies. So recently, the IETF have chartered the WIRS working group, and today we invited Murray, who was the working group chair, to give you a presentation. WHOIS is as an issue has both technical and policy components, and our objective is to update you often and regularly so that the policy process is aware of this, and we're also listening to you and taking the feedback back to the community. So we hope such dialogue and exchange could lead to a better result in terms of replacing WHOIS. So with that, I'll give the mic to Murray, and after that, we can answer your questions. Thank you.
Do you have a PowerPoint or anything, or just going to speak?
Should I wait for it or just wing it until she's ready? Okay. I'll try to remember what the first few slides say. I know one of them is my name. My name is Murray Kucharavi. I am the co-chair of the WIRDS working group at IETF, which has been chartered to take into consideration the needs of the WHOIS community. What are the problems now, and how can we get to where you guys and the rest of the industry would like to be with WHOIS? There's a short inventory of deficiencies. Steve alluded to a couple of them. One is internationalization. There is no ability at the moment to express in a standard way WHOIS information, registration information that is contains anything other than. Anything other than basic ASCII text, so the new demands for being able to support internationalized character sets are not there. Some servers have implemented these things, but they're not standard, so you need a specific client to talk to a specific service, and standards people obviously don't like solutions like that. So there's also no data framework for any given field you can think of, like a date or a phone number. No two services have necessarily the same way to express the same information, and for automated consumption of this by security vendors or things that aren't humans, there's no standard way to express this stuff, and this needs to be addressed as well. I see. Go to the next one. another important point is we're synced up. The other important point is the inability to give differential access capabilities. So, if you want to provide only a subset of the WHOIS registration information to certain clients, there's no way to do that right now except by IP address. And since IP addresses are shared, especially with the rollout of CGN and things of this nature, it's not a very good distinguishing characteristic. So we need something better than that to say, this particular client is entitled to more information or different information than this other one. Current WHOIS simply can't do that. And by privileged, I don't necessarily mean access to PII. I might simply mean don't rate limit this guy. We know that he's a legitimate querier. He's not trolling for data. There's some more legitimate use to this. Next slide, please. So the working group, back one, there we go. The working group is chartered to first standardize a data framework. So replies are supposed to contain or should contain these particular fields at a minimum. Here are standard ways to deliver certain objects, like a standard date format. I'll use the word standard a lot because of what the IETF does. We want to focus on doing this over RESTful services and HTTP because there's plenty of code out there right now to roll these things out and do them. That makes the rollout of both clients and servers a very lightweight concept. We are aware that we took a run at this in the past with the CRISP working group some time ago, which had many of the same goals in mind that this working group has. However, CRISP, due to its complexity and other issues, has simply not gained the traction that we're hoping that this will. And as you'll see in another slide or two, it's already gaining some traction. But the general goal is to produce a very simple, something easy to implement, and it supports internationalization. Next, please. We want to include the capability of differential service based on clients, and that's actually very easy with HTTP because there are plenty of protocols associated with HTTP that enable things like client authentication, which is how you would do differential service. And also, HTTPS is available, which can secure the question and secure the answer. So there's no possibility of observation by third parties. So, and also one important goal here that we have is we don't want to produce a protocol that is used by names as different from one that is used by the RIRs. Ultimately, the questions should look the same and the answers should look the same as much as is practical. So that is one of our stated goals as well. Next, please. A quick demonstration or representation of what REST and HTTP gives you. You form the question, it looks like a regular URI. You have the location of the service, which in this case is Aaron. The REST POC part tells you what type of question you're asking, and the last part is the actual question, what is the subject of the query. URIs have been standardized for a long time, so there's actually very little for us to have to do here to say here's how you would provide the query piece of the service. Other properties are that it's stateless and can be layered and cacheable. These things make for a very lightweight yet expandable service. Next, please. Now, the exciting thing about this is that the number registries have already put up implementations of this. There are 5 of the 6 RIRs have prototypes. And Aaron, for example, their RESTful service now gets more queries than the traditional port 43. So we know there's momentum behind this. We know the industry wants this and is already adapting to it. Next, please. So the working group was chartered in April. We have 5 documents we're considering right now. They are in very early stages of development, so now would be a great time to get more feedback from any constituency of ICANN that wants to be involved. The first is a simple explanation of how this works over HTTP. The second is how to form the question. The third is how to form the answer, and we're leaning towards JSON very, very much right now. We considered XML for a while and decided that was not the way we wanted to go. Security considerations, a document about how to secure the data, how to authenticate clients, how to distinguish what one client might see from another, what policy implications there might be. There is no, I hesitate to use the word policy. The IETF is not pushing policy in any regard. This is more of a statement of, if you have this policy, here is how you would do it, rather than this needs to be your policy. That's not our purview at all. And redirections. So Aaron, for example, receives a query for a LACNIC address. They issue the redirect. So this is how you would do it under the new framework. We're scheduled to complete our work in the working group by the end of December of next year. That doesn't mean the RFCs will all be published by then. They go through their own review processes. But the working group itself should be finished by December of next year. Next, please. I think that's all I wanted to cover. The next 2 slides are process stuff we decided we want to skip. So next one and one more. So if you're interested in participating, the next actual meeting will be in Atlanta in November, I believe on the Monday of in the set of dates shown there. The URL that's here can take you to the working group's charter, the actual drafts that I talk about so you can read them and comment on them, contact information for myself, the other working group chair, and the area director supervising our work, and how to get on the mailing list or access the archives if you want to see what we've already argued about. And that's it for me, I believe, unless there are questions.
Hi, I'm Jeff Newman with Newstar. Steve, when you presented this to the council, I think you had said August of 2013. Yeah. Is it now December? And then just if you can give us kind of an update of how long, once it gets out of the working group through the area directors. So are we looking at 2014 or 2015 before we implement it?
Sure. So there are, when I presented to the council, I was saying there are 4 drafts, that the last draft was supposed to finish by August. Now there's a 5th draft on the redirection, and that will push it by a couple of months. But that draft is not, the first 4 draft is not, is it dependent on the 5th draft?
No, this is Murray again. No, And it's entirely possible that the first draft we push through will be published before December. I mean, they don't all go on an omnibus in one big operation to the reviewing boards. One of them will finish in March, one of them will finish in May, one of them will finish in... This is just the date for the very last one that we expect to finish on our list of guidelines.
Okay, then my question, follow-up to Steve. ICANN is at least in the new TLD agreements, and then they're trying to do it in... I know it's in .com, I think, and maybe .net. But there's a requirement to adopt the standard as soon as it's... within a certain number of days after it's approved as a standard. I guess my question is, I don't want to be... making changes to who is in my system on a rolling basis depending on when the drafts come out. So I'd ask for some guidance to say, is it 135 days after the last draft? Or, you know what I'm saying, I don't want to do it on a rolling basis.
Sure. So there's a, you know, as I shared with you last time, it took probably roughly 2 to 4 months when the draft submit to the IESG for it to be published as standards. So we're probably looking at first quarter of 2014. So if that will help you.
You have to forgive me. I'm not familiar with the parts of the policy you're talking about. So I can tell you that redirection will come out last. It will not, as far as I'm aware, will not be a mandatory part of the protocol, as a part of the base protocol. So strictly off the top of my head, you could do something like, say the base protocol needs to be implemented by now, and if you want to add redirection, it will come a little later. I don't know if that would work for your work or not. But the base stuff will be done long before the redirection stuff. It comes out as a rolling thing.
You know, thanks. And that's interesting because technically the contractual provisions in our agreements don't say you only have to implement the mandatory portions of any kind of standard. It should, you know, now I'm thinking about it, it should say that you must implement the mandatory and you may implement the non-mandatory, but if you start implementing the non-mandatory, then you have to do it in accordance with the way the standard is, right? I mean, that's typical in contracts. So it's something to think about. I know, you know, for VeriSign, you've already agreed to contractual language, but you might want some clarification. I know that's something they're pushing for .biz, and I know that the new TLDs have committed. So this is actually something we need to put on our radar and get some guidance as to when this would need to be implemented.
I think this, what I'm hearing, is important feedback to me that I tell the IETF we can't be messing with the milestone list, which we like to do over there quite a bit, actually. So, if it's important and has impacts over here, I'll let them know that.
Any other questions or feedbacks we can take back to the IETF?
I don't hear any, but thank you very much for coming. That's very informative and helpful.
Thank you, David.
Thank you.
Back to our agenda, GNSO review and structure. Do you want to talk about that?
So there's nothing, I mean, this issue is one that's being discussed. It was discussed in with the board, actually. So there's really two parts that are going on right now. But they're interrelated. There is how do the new GTLDs impact the structure on an ongoing basis, but there's also the GNSO review, which is every 5 years, or it's supposed to be 5 years from the date that the final report was published. So the last final report of the last review was published 5 years ago in 2008. So, you know, there's a lot of discussion going on. There's no action items for the council at this point. There's a working group or drafting team or something formed by the council to look into some of these issues, but there's really, it's just at a discussion stage at this point. Obviously, if you have some ideas, we have been urging the people who are doing the review to focus not on structure but on issues that have come out. So, you know, don't automatically think that review has to mean that we have to change it, you know, no longer a bicameral house or structure. But, yeah, Keith.
Yeah, thanks. This is Keith Drazik. One of the things that we've talked about in the past, I think, is, you know, as a review of the GNSO takes place, it's perfectly reasonable for that review to address, you know, sort of assess the changes that were made coming out of the last review and the recommendations there. So I think to the extent that the conversation starts to drift into, you know, focusing on a restructuring or something like that, or something more expansive, I think it'd be helpful for us and our counselors to sort of bring the focus back to, hey, it's reasonable at this stage to do an assessment of the recommendations that came out of the last review and not get too far down the road of, you know, trying to expand, you know, and focus on a restructuring before we have all the data we need to make that assessment. It's almost like, you know, you can start with something very sort of targeted, which is reasonable, but to go much further than that might not be. Thanks.
Okay, thanks, Keith. I believe Javier has just come in, and we're ready for the presentation on the budget. And yeah, well, if you'd like to come up, we can make room here.
Good afternoon, everyone. There's more people on the stage than in the room, though. That's fine. Thank you for the invitation to come. I think one of the items that I understand this group wanted to be able to discuss is the budget process. I can see here in the agenda, fiscal year 13 budget and operating plans. I think we're actually, if we're talking about the ad hoc groups, we're actually talking about the fiscal year 14 process that we're going to enter into just now. So there's been started in Prague. There has been a process of three working groups looking at three different aspects of the budget process to review the issues in the process and those issues that we could identify improvements on for the purpose of implementing those improvements in the upcoming fiscal year 14 budget process. So these three groups have been working between Prague and now on identifying those improvements and identifying potential solutions. Various people participated to those groups. I want particularly to thank Chuck Gomes for the large involvement that he has had in these groups and the quality of the input that he provided. But there's been a number of community members across several organizations participating to those groups. Those groups concluded their work on Sunday night, late afternoon, and we have, and there is a presentation tomorrow that will largely summarize the work of those groups into an overview of the budget process for the next year, notably emphasizing these changes and these improvements that have been formulated through those working groups. The three working groups are relative to the timeline of the budget, the linkage between the strategic plan and the budget, and the structure and content of the budget. That's the three topics, all of which really being very much connected together. So much so that the model of the working group, I think, has fit well. Apparently, the perspective of the community on how to interact on these subjects. Certainly, from my perspective, it's also a very good approach. It has its limitations and its requirements, but it's certainly more effective than nothing on one hand, than the public comment process on the other hand, as it relates to the ability that the working groups provide to actually interact in a short-term fashion together. So I'm very pleased with these working groups so far, and we will implement and launch this year a process that includes improvements from those working groups. I don't know if there's any specific question. I didn't intend to go into details. I don't know how much detail is useful for this group, and I'm happy to answer any more detailed question there is or other questions on that specific subject from anyone.
This is your opportunity.
There doesn't seem to be any. Chuck, you had a question? Yes.
It's not a question whether I would like to take the opportunity for the group here, because I really haven't had opportunity to do that, to make sure that you provide us, within the stakeholder group, feedback in terms of where we're at. And the easiest way to do that is for you to look at, I wish we had the one slide here right now that shows the process that's being proposed. But in essence, one of our concerns in the past process was that we submitted comments after the posting of the draft budget on May 1st, extensive comments. We received a little bit of feedback before the board approved the motion to approve the budget, and then there are still quite a few questions that we haven't received feedback on yet. There were some additional feedback provided, but they still weren't all answered. Now, in the new process, just to be very brief, it's proposed that the draft budget still be provided on May 1st. Now, but that it's understood that that will not allow for any significant changes in that budget. So how do we solve the problem? Because that didn't solve our problem, right? In the framework process, which would be started in October of the previous year, there, throughout that process, there will be a lot of project detail information provided that hopefully will allow us to provide our input, our detailed input and comments, much earlier in the process so that it can be responded to, and so that ultimately when we get to the draft budget in on May 1st, it will be... It will already be incorporated if it's going to be incorporated, and our concerns will, whether addressed or not, will at least be responded to. So hopefully that makes sense without seeing a diagram, but if anybody has any feedback on that, provide it so that Paul and I and Brett know as well on this process. And, of course, you can provide it tomorrow in the finance session, 11 o'clock, right, tomorrow?
Yes. So just to elaborate just a little bit on what Ken said and to be very transparent, one of the many comments, but one that's been provided a lot and by several organizations in the past, is that the comments that are provided are not answered or not taken into account. And by looking at the process, it wasn't rocket science to figure out why. When the public comment period, which is a useful process and necessary one, finishes, we're June 15th. The board needs to approve the budget before the end of June and usually does so in the last meeting of the fiscal year, which has usually happened around, let's say, the 20th of June. So when there is 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 days to take into account, to receive comments, look at them, compile them, analyze them, review them, and answer them, and implement some of those comments, assuming that everybody agrees on them, into a budget that's taken 9 months to develop and do that in basically a day or a day and a half, of course it's not going to happen. So the issue is not to try to give a little bit more public comment time. The issue is to find a way to provide to bring the process up front so that we provide more information earlier in the process and allow the interaction with the community on that information more and in a more interactive manner. So the main improvement that has been identified through the working groups is to expand the phase of the budget process corresponding to the framework. Expand it in terms of the amount of time that we're going to allocate to it, the amount of information that we, the ICANN staff, provide and to the community for input so that that information is sufficiently detailed that it allows those of you who review it for comment to actually formulate comments. So you need to have enough information about what the projects are about, what the cost components are about, what the timeline or suggested timelines are about, metrics and deliverables and so on. So the objective is to provide sufficient amount of detail for adequate input earlier in the process and allow for the adequate interactions with those members of the community who look at that information to effectively communicate, exchange, and take those comments into account immediately as possible. So that's to try to address the point that Chuck was making. I will conclude on that subject by commenting on the other item that I think was on the agenda, which is the comments from last year. I think we've expanded on the reason why the comments could not be answered well. There was a very limited amount of time to do so, and there's a very limited opportunity to implement some of them. We have looked back over the past few weeks at some of the answers that we provided on some of the comments, and we have tried to give another shot at providing a little bit more information on those questions from the past process that had been formulated and not either answered or fully answered. And I will circulate a document with Chuck and those of you who are interested to ensure that we're providing a bit more information. What I don't want to do is redo the entire fiscal year 12 budget process, and I want to be able to move forward at some point, but I don't want to ignore the technical questions that also can be answered easily. The questions that we have had trouble answering in the past, especially within that time frame, are those questions that are a lot more structural to the process and that can only be changed, implemented going forward than looking at the end of the process. I'll stop there. I don't know if there's more comments, and I see that Raimundo is in queue for a comment.
And this is Raimundo Beca. As a member of the of the PIR board, I have been participating in two of the groups, and it's not mentioned there, but I was in the overall strategic planning and in the structure.
Yeah. Oh, Ray, I'm sorry, we can't hear you.
I was mentioning that as a member of the PIR board, and as a former chair of the finance committee of the ICANN board, I've been working in two of these groups, and it's not mentioned in the slide. In particular, I was in the overall strategic planning and in the structure of and content of the budget. It's only for the record.
Thank you.
Yeah, there has been a number of participants to those working group. Raimundo has participated to quite a few of those calls on two different topics. There's been representatives from ALAC, GNSO, various groups of the GNSO, the registrars, the registries. I think the only group that we didn't have representation from during those working groups, any of those groups or any of the meetings, is the GAC. But that's it.
Any other questions or discussion?
Oh, go ahead, John.
Okay. Yeah, I don't think you mentioned this, but you may have. The new TLD, the current new TLD budget for ICANN, in the past there used to be some scorecards or information posted on the ICANN website about the budget on a, like a monthly basis and how it meets with actual spending, so actuals versus budget. Is that something you would consider doing again? Question one. Question two, how is the new TLD budget looking like compared to actuals, and how as a community could we have some transparency into that?
So it's funny because I haven't seen anything like that that we have provided in the past, though I did look. But irrespective, it's been quite surprising to me to not necessarily be able to find in the past that type of information on, let's call it technically an actual versus budget status. So we have been working to put in place a process of reporting. And when I say we, I should specify, of course, the ICANN staff and mainly me, basically, working with the BFC, the Board Finance Committee, to design a process of reporting that would include that information. It would include it, it will include it, for the ICANN operations as well as the new GTLD program. We close the ICANN books every month, right? So we have, we produce every month draft management financial statements. What we're working with the board on designing is a number of a reporting package, basically, right? A certain amount of information on the financial statements on a periodic basis. We're thinking right now on a quarterly basis to share with the Board Finance Committee, provide explanation as to where we are against the budget in the year, provide a certain number of comments to explain those variances, and we're aiming towards a quarterly cycle for that. Part of the discussion on this process is also how do we communicate that information on an ongoing basis to, I would say, everyone. So not only the community, but anyone outside the community as well. To be very transparent, at least in words, what I have in mind is something very similar to what any publicly listed company does, which is 10Qs, or in the U.S., 10Qs, 10Ks, that provide a reporting on a quarterly basis. That's what I'm used to. So we're developing that. It's a bit, I thought we were starting from scratch, but I'm glad that we're not. But nonetheless, I think we need to be able to put this in place. I think it's going to be a little bit progressive over the course of the next of the current fiscal year. We have laid out a tentative calendar with the BFC, and I think the BFC has indicated its preference to give a one shot or two at this exercise on a quarterly basis. And once we're all comfortable that we're presenting the information and the right information, then publishing that information. I would also expect, that's what I think I want to do, and we'll see where the BFC goes on that, but that we would have also an equivalent of an investor call. So in my views, that would then be with the community and those of the community who are interested in that to have a call on that publication on a quarterly basis. So that's what I have in mind. I've laid out, I want to be transparent with this group as to what we're working on, and I think we're going to be fine-tuning this approach over the next few months. Just to conclude on the new GTLD program, because you had a question on that. So the new GTLD program and its financial impact will be included in that package, just like any other piece of information. Because we have not yet published information on actual versus budget for the new GTLD program, I will not directly answer your question on how those financials currently show versus the budget. It's not rocket science either to say that we're globally in line. We're at the beginning of the when I say beginning, we're 3.5 months into the evaluation process. But that's also the phase that's going fairly consistently with what we had planned from a financial standpoint. I think we'll have a bit more information over the next few months on how the program goes. There's also another subject that's been raised, of course, is trying to take into account the impacts of assumptions that are different in the program or aspects of the program that are different today than they were at the time we built the budget. So that's also another element to include in that process of reporting when we can implement it. But we're working on that for the next few weeks and months. I hope this is helpful.
Any other questions or discussion? If not, thank you very much, Amir. I appreciate your taking the time to come in.
No problem. Thank you very much for the invitation and the time.
And we'll see you tomorrow morning.
Yes.
Is Vonda here? Oh, thanks. We now have about 20 minutes, but we really only have 15 at the very most. Because we have to move across the bridge to the harbor room to meet with the registrars promptly at 4. Welcome.
Okay, thank you very much for having us here. We are here as last year to ask you about recommendations and also to suggest you take a look in our website, in our report, where the matching, the matrix matching that we prepare to respond to ATRT about the recommendations you have done, and all the other members and the board itself, both for the group of board members and also for GNSO members. So there is over there very detailed. And how we get these metrics? We have two processes. One was inside the committee. We have analyzed each profile and to select each people. And for the board members, we send a pre-selected group to an external independent contracted company for analyzed profiles. And they gave back some detailed points, and before that, in February this year, I just met this company in Germany, and we discussed all the recommendations to make sure they will try to make the correct questions to get the correct answers from the candidates to match those recommendations. So at the end, we came out with the final slate, and we publish that. And those selectees and the slates of the board and candidates for each one constituents are there with the matching metrics for each point that have been raised during this interview. So I would like to ask you for the future 2013 non-com to see if there is any other recommendation, or you do you prefer to withdraw some of those recommendations or add anything else, just to make sure that we have some very clear recommendation to follow. So doing that, I also would like to invite you to go to our website and see that we try to at least start to be more transparent and accounted to the community. So from December last year, we have posted and updated all the information we could share with the community, timeline, up-to-date timeline, and all the processes are there, the information that the candidates are getting, more explanations about how to do things, and et cetera, et cetera. Okay.
So thanks for coming in. I think part of the problem that we have, and you don't get too many questions, is that there's just even, I think you said it right, you're as transparent as you're allowed to be, essentially.
Yeah.
What can we do going forward to get rid of some of the confidentiality requirements? I'm not talking about confidentiality about the candidates. I think yes. Obviously that should stay confidential, and even the information about the deliberations that take place. But part of our problem is that there's no way for us to assess anything, because when we ask people questions, it's always, well, I can't really talk about that because it's confidential, and every person signs a confidentiality agreement. So, I mean, I don't know if other people have this problem. I've never been on the nominating committee, so I don't have that past experience to draw from. But one of my problems is it's hard for me. We've told you year after year the kind of thing that we're looking for, and then we see the people that you appoint. Sometimes there's a match, and sometimes there's not. We don't know why there's not a match. Right? We don't know what went into the deliberation process. And I think we really need to take a good look at the procedures and look at not just that you've disclosed timelines and dates, but really disclosing
the process,
more information. Yeah. The process, the, you know, and I know you're not going to respond to the allegations and certain things that were said, and we have no idea whether any of that's true or not. But I think that's the problem. We don't know whether they're true or not, and we would like to know more. We would like to know more of the inner workings, but we're just not getting that information.
Okay. But, well, the process is also posted. But to give you a very clear issue is we get the information from the candidates. We analyze each candidate, and we make a pre-selection of those candidates based nowadays, based on the requirements, exactly this list of requirements that we got from GNSO, from all constituencies here, ALAC, etc. So this is a kind of guideline that are published over there. So these guidelines also show to the candidates what we expected from them. We will check that profiles with this kind of requirements.
So one of my questions, how do I know, well, let's just say in this community there's been, as Fadi has said several times, the contracted parties have been vilified by the rest of the community. We think wrongly. But we know, or we believe, that there's a bias in the nominating committee not to appoint anyone that is affiliated with a contracted party. That is something that has been, well, again, it's just things we kind of hear, but we obviously have no way to test it. So I don't know when someone is, you know, you get the requirements. I don't know that, and I'll make this up, that the five at-large people, which is another issue we might want to discuss, but that's not really, I think that's a structural issue. I don't know that they go, oh, that's a person associated with the contracted party. So on these criteria, I'm going to give them a zero or however you score them. And then it skews the results to matching to the requirements. We have no data. It would be great if on an anonymous basis someone could go in, look at the requirements, look at how they were scored by individuals, not by name, but by their affiliation, to see whether there's some sort of inherent bias in the selections. Because I know for a fact that there have been people that have applied in the past that have been affiliated with a contracted party, and I know for a fact they weren't selected. I don't know why, right? There could be very legitimate reasons. But I've yet to see any year where anyone affiliated with a contracted party has made it through the process.
Well, I personally, I'm 2 years over there. I haven't seen nothing against athletes. Well, I see one clear issue that the CC NSO asked us not to select any CC affiliate to them. This is clear requirement, but it was for them, not for the others. For the others, it's completely open, and we do have some candidates that are, and they went to the final list. And, you know, when you compare with the others, some others are better. there was not any special consideration to just dismiss this guy just because of that. No. But to have a, you know, I don't know, but if even we need to consult the legal counsel, if... we can open up each because it's the maybe the summary, but you are open a person candidacy, and sometimes people don't want to make expose it like that. That is the problem. If we can have this your suggestion, like you know, how is the score? He gave, or ALAC gave, or the other gave, you know. And for this particular candidate, you are open the candidacy of this candidate. So you are breaking the confidence. That's the problems. Well, we can discuss later more detail. Please.
Okay, Chuck Holmes, I'll be really brief because we need to go to the registrar meeting. But number one, you know, this was a selection a year ago, but I would say a selection was made in Thomas Roessler that had good knowledge of our environment and so forth, so that's a positive. My next comment is really for us, not for the NOMCOM. When I looked at the requirements that Vonda showed on the slide that came from the GNSO,
yeah,
they were so general and generic and subjective that it wasn't even helpful. What we need to do, we need to take very seriously the requirements that go in from our side, and I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah, those are the requirements we recorded in these meetings that we get. So we need to follow what we got from the community. We cannot invent any requirement. So those are the requirements we receive from each one. And from the board is completely public. They publish their requirement. The same thing could happen here. You could write and send to the next chair the opportunity, your requirements, very clear, and they will be posted. But most of the requirements, Chuck is right, that came from the community was not so clear. That one from CC is very, very clear. Some from ALAC, it's very, very clear. But some of the GNSO are not so clear. But one was clear. Need to know the I can need to know the market. It's a very clear issue. So I'd like to give some opportunity to Iro to present himself.
Thank you, Vonda. I'm afraid we've run out of time. We
just let him say one. Just give him a minute.
Sure. Yrjö Länsipuro. I come from ISOC, Finland. I don't have actually too much to say at this point because we start our work only on Friday. Friday and Saturday we'll be meeting here in Toronto, the new nominating committee. There we, among other things, will go through the our rules of procedure, and we take all input we get, including, of course, the recommendations from the 2012 committee, and see whether and how we can amend, revise our rules of procedure. I can also say that we're happy for all input and all comments. And even if somebody hits us on the head by a bottle, we still try to see if there is a message, a letter in that bottle, perhaps. So anyway, we try to put these, our guidelines, together, and then, of course, go on to discuss our timetable, which is pretty challenging this time because, as you know, next year's meetings, ICANN meetings, are later. I think that historically they are later than ever. So that presents some challenges. But most important, I would like to ask for your help. You all know people whom you think that they might make wonderful directors on the board of ICANN or GNSO, CCNSO, whatever. Please ask them to apply. And as Wanda said, the website will be updated shortly, and the instructions will be there how to apply, because without a good candidate pool, there's very little we can do. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and I'm sorry that we've had to be so abrupt, but we do have to go to our next meeting.
Yes, certainly.
We're going to adjourn this meeting and reconvene over at the registrar's stakeholder group meeting. We can stop the recording now. Thank you. Thank you all.